You are listening to the Fringe Radio Network. FringeRadioNetwork.com.
I've got one that can see.
You are now listening to the Eyes Wide Open podcast.
Stay awake, don't sleep.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Eyes Wide Open. I'm your host, Leonard Olivares, and today I'm going to be interviewing John Potash. John Potash is an author and a documentary filmmaker. John Potash, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Len.
Now, John Potash, for the people that don't know you, just can you give a brief introduction about who is John Potash?
Well, I work as a counselor, counseling with an expertise in addictions and trauma and mood disorders, but I've been doing this for about 30 years. I started as an addictions counselor and then went back to grad school for more advanced degrees. But while in grad school, I also studied sociology a bit. And that's where I got more into the political scene. I was always writing about politics, at least writing about a good bit from the, say, 90s onwards. And was working on the research for my book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA's Murderous Targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lenin, Cobain, Tupac, and other activists, since about 1991. And took a little tangent from that just to write the FBI war on Tupac Shakur and black leaders.
Right. So what got you started to want to write about the books that you've written about? Like, you know, what was the catalyst that started you on this path?
Well, when I was counseling in Baltimore City starting in 1989, I heard a lot of stories from my clients about how they thought that the government was trafficking the drugs in from other countries into the United States, the CIA in particular. And so I researched that and some things that were going on with musicians and aspects of police, U.S. intelligence, and targeting activists that I was researching, you know, anti-war activists and civil rights activists. And I was involved in a lot of anti-war activism myself during the Gulf War of 1991 and other wars. But so that's basically what got me into it.
So what got you into wanting to be a drug counselor? How did you end up doing that?
Well, I abused drugs in high school and weaned off most drugs in college, and never developed a full-fledged addiction, but I definitely had an abuse issue, and that's the main part of it. Part of it was being a psych major.
Right. So being a drug counselor, you've seen a lot, and seen what drugs actually do to people, how they destroy families and how they destroy lives, and the recovery is actually, really hard, for a lot of people. Not everybody is successful at recovery. They may recover and then they lapse, they fall off, or something triggers them, whether it be a death in the family, whether it be a divorce or something with the kids, or a loss of job. Those can be trigger points to have a person go back into abusing drugs again, correct?
Sure.
Yeah. So, and see, I was a drug addict too. I stopped. I'm 41 now, and I got clean when I was 27. But I was addicted to methamphetamine. So, over here in Los Angeles, that was a big thing, and especially in the Hispanic culture, in the Mexican culture, in the gang culture, it was a big thing of methamphetamines. Now it's reached all color lines. Where back before when I was doing it, it was just mainly just white and Mexicans that were doing it. But now you have like, the black people are doing it. Samoans are doing it. Asians are doing it. So it crossed all boundaries, all color lines, drugs, I look at meth as the new crack, how crack cocaine was in the 80s. This is how meth is for today. And it's pretty, it's some pretty strong stuff. You know, it's not made in the bathtub anymore. Stuff is coming from across the border now. Super dope. So yeah. You know, I was interested in that too, because you know, what's weird is, being in the drug culture and having friends that sold dope and sold dope myself. And, you know, people that were making a lot of money, I'm talking, you know, were in our cities. I'm from the city of Long Beach in Long Beach, California. In our city, they would be, you know, FBI agents, DEA agents, you know, Homeland Security, ATF. It'd be the whole nine. Everybody would be. So when houses would get raided, there'd be multiple alphabet, you know, agencies that would come and raid the home and, putting surveillance on through the streets. And, you know, so everybody knew that the feds and, you know, the federal agents were around. It was just a way of life. And to find out, you know, that the drugs were being brought in by our government, you know, it's insane. And this goes on to about, you know, the documentary film that you made and plus the book that you wrote. I've seen the film. I've recently got your book. And I know that I've heard you on other interviews say that the book is a lot more, that you had to like kind of like really cut it down in the film. But you know, you did an excellent job in that film. Go ahead and explain that book in that excellent film.
Yeah, so well, yeah, the, you know, like a film, a 2-hour film is a would pan out into about a 60-page script to make a 2-hour film based on the speed of conversation, but that's basically what it plays out to. And so the book, of course, is about 430 pages. Now, you know, there's a number of pictures and endnotes and things like that in the book, but nonetheless, you still have at least 350 pages of content versus about 60 pages of content. So yeah, the book's got a whole lot more. Nonetheless, I think the film is a good encapsulation of the book overall. And so yeah, it's basically going over the way that the wealthiest, you know, kind of families in our society, in American culture and British culture, but mostly I'm focusing on American society, gained incredible wealth through opium shipping, and then used that wealth to then control various institutions in our society, but particularly to start the CIA, which, when it was founded with the National Security Act of 1947, in effect made itself above the law. And after that, after, you know, starting in 1947, it proceeded to test a lot of psychedelics. And it did this with a lot of German Nazi scientists that it saved after World War II through Operation Paperclip. And some of these German scientists, such as a guy named Plotner and Hoffman, worked on these projects using drugs, testing drugs for use in what they called unconventional warfare, according to their own documents. The documents were revealed for a project called MKUltra. And MKUltra had 149 sub-projects. So it was a sort of a rainbow project. And, you know, an umbrella project covering all these other sub-projects. And so these sub-projects used, you know, in their own documents, they say, use drugs on, you know, as weapons, you know, and the warfare it talks about, though, people, you know, picture foreign lands in warfare, but no, it's actually, according to U.S. Senate Church Committee report, they say that the drugs such as LSD were used when people at all social levels, Americans at all social levels, and were used often on them against their knowledge and without their knowledge. It was slipped into their drinks and things like that. And I showed the evidence that it was used in the majority of its use was against people that were protesting for civil rights or against the Vietnam War and other wars. And so that's how it was used, you know, as a weapon against American dissidents.
Right. So everybody, the book and the documentary film is called Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA War on Musicians and Activists. Now, where did you get that title? Explain a little bit about that title. You know, where did you come up with that title from?
Yeah, I just tried to figure out a way to you know, encapsulate the whole idea of the book in a short way. You know, it's still a long title, but I just think it basically covers a lot of what I intended for it to cover. And with the musicians, the angle is the fact that it's not easy to get people to use, you know, drugs. You know, they're foreign, they're strange, they're scary. But when you get people's idols, you know, the musicians they love, if you can manipulate them to use these drugs and, you know, pretend like the musicians love these drugs, it can get the people that follow these musicians to use these drugs. So they kind of, you know, manufacture the demand where it wasn't, you know, like who would normally take a needle and shoot it in their arm, you know, and shoot up some foreign substance, except if John Lennon was doing it and they thought, oh, wow, you know, my favorite musician, John Lennon, does it. It must not be too bad. Or Kurt Cobain does it. Must not be too bad. Or, you know, or Jimi Hendrix, you know, he snorted heroin or he tripped. So it must be, you know, produce genius musicians, you know. And so that's kind of the way they basically sold it to us. And the sad thing is these people who I talk about, most of them were musical geniuses, of course, and they were manipulated. But then when they started sobering up and getting more into activism, they were done away with. And that's the general pattern with all these musicians.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It seems like it's okay as long as you're going and you're just pushing garbage to our youth. You go ahead, you know, it's all good. But as soon as you want to do anything good, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, the average person would be like, what's wrong with what they're doing? You know, but I think what it is because the influence that they have, you know, and I think that they get the influence that they see so much that they begin to see that a lot of this stuff is just garbage. You know, they come to that realization like this is, you know, there's more to life than what is being that I'm being forced to push out. Or, you know, I think that they end up waking up and say, hey, man, there's something that's guiding me to do this. And I don't want to do it no more. You know, I don't want to be used as a puppet no more. And so as soon as they step over that line, it seems like right away something happens to them, you know, right away. It's almost like the, you know, the powers that be are just like, you know, it always gets me because if these people are so, you know, strong, but yet they're so scared of one voice.
Well, I think that these musicians didn't know they were being manipulated. That's the thing. You know, that's the way I generally see it. I mean, some might, but I don't think most of the musicians I talk about in my book knew they were being manipulated. Except John Lennon was actually someone said that John Lennon was told by Marshall McLuhan, that a media guru. He's written some incredible books, such as I can't remember the names of his most famous books. I believe will come to me later, maybe. But I was told, you know, after I wrote my book, I was told that Marshall McLuhan told John Lennon he was a kind of a useful fool in the fact that in the way he was using drugs and promoting them, and he didn't never realize it. John Lennon got really mad, but came back a few days later and said, well, you know, I'd like to hear what you have to say about it. And then he knew that he was being manipulated by the powers that be to promote, you know, acid and other drugs to some extent. He didn't know fully what it was all about. Marshall McLuhan just told him what he thought it was about. And so Lennon got more radical. He declared himself a socialist. He was very, you know, anti-Vietnam War. But he still had people around him trying to manipulate him. And, he went to seclusion for a good 5 years or so, just raising his son. But then when he came out of seclusion, of course, he actually announced that he was going to lead a march of Teamsters in San Francisco to support their, you know, labor rights. And, of course, he came out with that Double Fantasy album that was, you know, in the top 10 immediately. And then he was shot and killed. And the best evidence is, you know, a longtime reporter named Fenton Bressler in Britain, who was also an attorney in Britain. He did a 7-year study and found that the CIA had basically used drugs and hypnosis to kind of create Mark David Chapman, to turn him into what they turned him into. But they also had another asset there, a guy named Jose San Janis Perdomo, became a doorman to the Dakota that night. He had been working there for a month or two or so. And it's believed that he also aided in the murder of John Lennon.
So all these documents that we have now, those came from the Freedom of Information Act, right? Correct?
Well, I got Freedom of Information Act documents on Tupac Shakur. But Fenton Bressler got Freedom of Information Act documents on John Lennon, yes. And he could get a number of them, you know, maybe 200 or 300 of them from the FBI that alluded to many documents in that of work with the CIA on this. But the CIA documents were much harder to get. I think you only got a few pages of CIA documents on their work with the FBI on this. But it's the best evidence is that when you look at about 30,000 MKUltra documents that were found, partly from the Senate Church Committee revealing them, partly from Freedom of Information Act documents like you're talking about that were gotten by other researchers on Project MKUltra, they uncover more that, yes, MKUltra was, pointing in that direction of using these drugs in these certain ways to create to use hypnosis to create people that could pull off these murders, and some of these documents say they were successful at doing that. And so this is some of the evidence regarding how this was all done.
So through MK Ultra, what were they using? What kind of people were they using? Were they using people like crazy people or people in prison or army people, military people? Like what type of people were they using to conduct these experiments?
Well, MKUltra in the 1950s, MKUltra first experiment, they first tested several dozen different drugs on thousands of soldiers. Soldiers were often considered cannon fodder or used as guinea pigs in different ways. And so I know in Edgewood Arsenal in the state in Maryland where I am, they used about 1,000 soldiers as guinea pigs to test loads of drugs on. They found out the effects of all these different drugs for how they can use them, LSD being their top drug. But, of course, it was many other drugs. And I think that cocaine and heroin were some of their drugs used, as part of their arsenal for their warfare, unconventional warfare. But I know ecstasy was one of them. And, a number of different other things besides that. But so that's how they first tested them. And then they funded a group called the Human Ecology Fund, which was part of, so the CIA put tons of money into this Human Ecology Fund, which was out of Cornell Medical School. And so that then gave loads of grants to professors at about 45 different colleges nationwide. But they also gave lots of money to do testing of drugs, and particularly LSD and psychedelic mushrooms, when people in prison and people in hospitals. And so in the colleges, they would give students, which today's equivalent of $150, for them to try LSD or psychedelic mushrooms. And so it's one of the most famous professors who got this grant was Timothy Leary at Harvard. But Ken Kesey was probably one of the most famous subjects of this grant money because he had gotten $150 to try LSD in Stanford, in the West Coast, in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Stanford University Hospital. And so Leary is eventually kicked out of Harvard for doing so much of this work and taking so much of the LSD himself. And into his life comes a guy named family, the Billy and Piggy Mellon Hitchcock, who then that family owns Gulf Oil and Mellon Bank. And that family also has people in U.S. intelligence positions, high level U.S. intelligence positions. So Piggy and Billy Mellon Hitchcock proceed to fund, Timothy Leary's some group called Institute for International Freedom, or something to the effect of these psychedelic centers in about a dozen places around the country, but also in Mexico, I believe. And they also give Leary, their mansion. You know, Billy Mellon Hitchcock gives Leary his, mansion, huge mansion on a 3,000 acre estate just an hour north of New York City. And I show the evidence that he did that to lure, really influential artists, writers, musicians from New York to this constant party at this mansion where they're testing all these psychedelics out. And they also lured lots of activists that were part of the Freedom Bus Rides to support Martha King, you know, during the Civil Rights era down south. They, you know, helped get blacks registered to vote and all. And so that was, you know, the best evidence shows that that was the reason for pushing this LSD, was to hurt the minds of all these young activists going into civil rights activist work, both in the East Coast and over in the West Coast, where Ken Kesey, after he was tested with LSD, he then is given a job at Stanford Hospital and given the keys to the LSD supply. And they allow him to steal as much LSD as he wants to then have constant parties at Stanford University, where he's living and, you know, going to graduate school. And he proceeds to get all these influential writers in the Stanford University writing program and other you know, artists around the area to come to these parties and start promoting LSD. And then a group called the Merry Pranksters form around him with a lot of ex-military as part of that group. And they influence him to take a bus and paint in psychedelic colors in 1963 or four, and then to travel with that bus in 1964 throughout the Civil Rights South, you know, blaring music, promoting LSD down the Civil Rights, you know, era South. And then they come back up to New York where they were headed, and they go through Harlem right after the race riots in Harlem. And of course, activists call them race rebellions, you know, rebelling against police brutality there. And so, he then that bus comes back to, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area where they were started from. And they proceed to have these, parties called acid tests. And they have vats of Kool-Aid that are spiked with LSD. And so they would have the Grateful Dead playing at their parties. And the parties got bigger and bigger. And people, everyone who came there was, you know, some knew there was acid in the Kool-Aid, but others didn't. And they were involuntarily dosed with loads of LSD. And that party ended up coming down to the Watts area in Los Angeles, where one of the biggest riots on the West Coast had just happened. So they were trying to get, you know, black riotous blacks who were activists to, you know, be dosed with LSD, you know, huge amounts without their knowing it.
So what would that do, though? What's the, 'cause I've done a lot of LSD in the past, and, you know, we'll talk about that, you know, later on in the show, but, what's the point of, okay, what is the end goal of giving people LSD in the masses, like, you know, mass producing it and giving it to masses of people? What's the end goal? What's the point of doing that?
There's two goals. Well, one thing is, you know, I took LSD about, half dozen times in my first year of college, and I saw my grades drop drastically, and I didn't know what to think about that, because I always thought LSD was associated with peace, love, and, you know, anti-war activism and 60s rebellion and all that. So I was duped in that way in the mid 80s. And so then I came to research it more, and I found it took a long time, but I as I was counseling people who had taken LSD, you know, some of them had some real severe effects from the LSD. And I found four studies that said that something is going wrong here with our, you know, LSD and the way it's affecting our brains. It's just, you know, the reason my grades dropped drastically after doing LSD and I lost abilities that I never regained is because it is doing a little bit of damage to our minds, to our brains. And so whether it's the LSD itself or the strychnine that the LSD is cut with, because strychnine is rat poison, one or the other is hurting our minds. And so they knew that they tested enough on all these soldiers to know that it could hurt people's minds, but it also could divert them. It could make them more easily manipulated, they found, when people have used LSD enough, it makes them a little more easily manipulated. Now, William S. Burroughs says that LSD makes people less competent. And I felt that way about myself, but I also found with counseling people over the years that they felt, a number of other people felt the same way. For a good while, it made me them less competent too. And it takes a long time to rebound from all that. And so I think that was the point of it, but it was also to divert them into this new lifestyle and hippie lifestyle. And what Timothy Leary said he wanted people to do is to tune in, turn on, and drop out. And he meant drop out of society and drop out of activism. He called activists civil rights and anti-war activism. He said they were people that had menopausal minds and they should be searching for spiritual truths, not political truths. So that's, I think, was the purpose of it.
So not everybody does LSD. So, I mean, of course, your book is drugs, used as a weapon against us. So we're talking about other drugs besides LSD, though, sure. Correct?
Yeah, speed, heroin, cocaine. But in the 60s, particularly heroin, because the Vietnam War, and I show the evidence of this from the CIA whistleblower, John Stockwell, who tells in my film about the fact that his fellow CIA agents were flying out of Vietnam with loads of heroin and bringing it to the United States. I have Judy Woodruff of PBS's Frontline talking about, all these whistleblowers saying that, the CIA was bringing heroin out of Vietnam into the United States, and even, showing CIA documents admitting this. And so, yes, heroin was flooding into American cities in the 60s with the Vietnam War growing. And doing that to really disrupt, families, disrupt communities. And of course, in the 70s and 80s, it was cocaine was growing in use in a major way, too, along with the heroin. And so they were using a lot of different drugs to disrupt, protesters' lives and community and, people of color's communities and families and communities and their lives in general.
Right, right. So, you would say that the push for wanting so much drugs into the community is twofold. So it'd be for the, for the government to make money to be able to do like black projects or whatever, and for the masses to be more easily influenced and moved because it's pretty much like a dumbing down of society.
Right. And so I talked to U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark in 1991 at a conference, and he was the U.S. Attorney General under President Johnson. And he said, I asked him what he thinks the government uses drugs for. And he says he thinks the government uses drugs to sedate and divide the masses. And so, yes, they're used in many ways for social control.
Right. I've seen this before, like growing up in, in the neighborhood and watching people and even myself. I would see, and this is, we're talking about like just regular weed, right? I used to be a big pothead and I used to love smoking weed, but I always tell my kids this. I said, there are 95% of the people that smoke, it affects kind of negatively. You have that 5% that can smoke and are very active. They're cleaning their house. They want to do work and they want to, but there's that big majority when they smoke, they become lazy. They don't want to do anything. And I've seen people that were about to get like college, they go to college and have their whole college paid for. And as soon as they started smoking, their ambition, their drive to want to do anything just dropped dramatically. They wanted to stay home. I have nothing against video games. I have nothing against, watching TV, but it just made them inactive. That spark that was in them, that drive that they had in the beginning was gone. And
yes.
I've seen it for myself, and I've, been in the projects, and, it just, people are just, they're just smoking, they're drinking. I'm not saying that, that everybody that smokes is like this. I'm not, because it affects everybody differently. But there's a big majority
yes.
of people that it does affect negatively. Or when I say negatively, I mean that it takes away your ambition. It takes away your drive. And you kind of just be like, whatever. You kind of become passive with things, mm-hmm. Nothing's really a big deal. You know, before when I used to smoke, I used to be like, man, let's, you know, let's go in the car. Let's hotbox the car. Let's listen to music and just chill out, you know, not do anything, you know, and it takes away. And sometimes there, I would have conversations, really good conversations about what's going on in the world. You mean, you know, but I wouldn't want to be active. You know, it was just like, oh, you seen that? Oh, you seen this? And, you know, so I've seen that now with marijuana being legal here in California. And it's not the same stuff that used to come from Mexico that was growing in the ground. A lot of the stuff when I was, you know, like in the 90s, I had a lot of friends that their families were ex-hippies and they were growing weed indoors. And so a lot of the weed back then was all coming from Mexico. So it was outdoor weed full of seeds, you know, light green. It was, some of it was okay. You know, it was all right, mid-grade. But I would get stuff that was grown seedless in, you know, in the homes. And it was a lot more powerful because it was grown with chemicals. And so the chemicals would give it like extra nutrients and all what it needed. And you can have a yield every 3 months, you know, versus once a year, you know. And I seen the difference that it did when I would smoke regular weed or hydroponic. And when I would smoke people out with hydroponic, they would literally couldn't move, like, because they were so used to smoking. We used to call it stress. The weed that used to come from Mexico, we used to call it stress here in California. Like, hey, you got any stress weed? So when they smoke, you know, they would smoke, you know, blunt after blunt after blunt with stress or joints, you know. And but when soon as they hit the hydroponic, they're like, oh man, I'm good. I can't even move. I can't even think. It just from going from natural to something that was grown chemically, you know, you can see the difference of how it affected people. And nowadays, in California, it's like almost impossible to find anything that's been grown naturally.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. So what I found is I totally agree with you. I mean, counseling people for 30 years, I've seen just so many people that, you know, I agree with you. It seems like about 95% of the people generally get lazier from weed. Now, there's the 5% that don't, and that's good for them. But so many, the great majority, you know, do get lazier and a little. And when they're high, of course, they're a little stupider. Everyone is. Yeah, maybe some people could be a little more creative when they're high. And okay, great if you can be, but it's not, you know, the norm. At least you might be creative in your mind, but playing it out's not so easy. You know, writing things out isn't so easy because, you know, I just write poetry and fiction. I'm getting back into fiction now, but I almost didn't graduate from high school because I was smoking weed every day. You know, I almost failed my calculus class and didn't get out of high school because of that. You know, and then when I got away from, you know, drugs, you know, completely by grad school, I was, you know, 395 in Columbia University grad school. So it's just, you know, it's incredible effect that weed can have over us and the way it can just change our motivation. And so I agree with you on that. But these days it's getting more and more dangerous because, as you say, yes, it isn't grown naturally, and it's incredibly stronger these days. And every time we smoke weed, I tell a lot of my clients who are into weed that, you know, you're allowing whoever touched that weed access to your brain. So they're putting all different kinds of chemicals in it that, and calling it different names based on the chemicals they add to it. So the additives could be opium, it could be all kinds of things. And so there's that, and plus the fact that some of my dealers told me they would spray their large stashes with roach killer to keep the rats away from it. So then you're smoking roach killer. But even if, you know, when it's regulated marijuana in the medical dispensaries, I'm glad if it's regulated and you don't get the foreign chemicals in it, but it's incredibly strong. And there's new studies, international studies, that are put together in a new book called Tell Your Children, which just came out this January, which suggests that there's a small percentage of people, small but significant percentage of people that don't react well to this incredibly potent weed, and they actually get very violent. And so a guy who graduated from Harvard Law School, for example, started murdering people, believe it or not. He's in jail for life. Another guy, you know, it's just another example, had a wife and two kids, nice middle class, you know, family that was doing well. And then he just got on weed regularly for some kind of pain issue, and he murdered his wife and kids. And this isn't reefer madness. This is just what's happened, you know, in the last year or two. And so this guy put it together for his book, Tell Your Children. He's a New York Times bestselling author who decided to just go from writing novels to nonfiction because of what he came upon. And he used to be a New York Times reporter. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen people they smoke and then they get very irritated. Very irritated, because they're like, they don't want to be bothered by anything or nobody messing with them. So if their kids are running around the house, they're yelling and screaming at them, shut the hell up. Because, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood where, you know, it's this was prevalent. So you have, you know, people that are low income people and they're smoking and they're just like, they get to the point where they're yelling and screaming and beating their kids because they won't shut up or they won't stop. You have a kid that's just like hyper running around the house, but nobody's paying attention to him. Nobody's like parenting him because the parents are high. And so the parents want just everything to be calm because they're calm. But when you have a hyper child running around, or it's just a little boy that just has energy, that just wants to play in the dirt, you know, and then you have to be focused as a parent to tell your child, okay, don't do that. Because you got to watch children. I've seen firsthand people beat their children because of just being children, because they were high and they got irritated. Now, you know, when you tell most people that disagree with this are most people that get high. So they're like, oh man, you're speaking against the weed. And, you know, but the reality, I used to be a major pothead for real. And when I was smoking in LA, hardly anybody was smoking hydroponic, man. And I used to have, and I had the connects to hydroponic. All the circles that I've been in, which in, you know, in the lower class income areas, everybody was getting just regular weed from Mexico. And I would come and I would smoke blunt after blunt and have people stuck. But I've seen this now growing where to the point where people, you know, where it's affecting people badly and it's affecting your parenting skills. If you have a newborn baby, your newborn baby is going to cry when they're hungry. Newborns need to be picked up. They need to feel touched. They need it. They need that. Now, when you're high, you just want to lay down, watch TV, trip out on some movies, play some video games. And if you're a mother, you don't want to be bothered by a crying baby that wants your attention and it needs to eat and needs their diaper change. So you get irritated. You begin to yell. And that brings trauma to a child because at that age, a baby is soaking everything in. Their mind is working. That's the way we were created, for our mind to soak everything, to learn languages, to learn motor skills. So if you are a low-income mother and you don't have, the baby's dad's not there and you're smoking and you have multiple children, you're going to get irritated. And the people that are around you that you're allowing to your home, they're going to get irritated. And this is just, you know, it's disaster. This is a recipe for disaster. This is a recipe to allow your children to get abused. And, you know, you have to think clearly. Now, I understand that sometimes, you know, getting high, look at drugs wouldn't be selling off, you know, they wouldn't be the problem that they are if they didn't feel good, period. They do. They do. But you have to understand that this is stealing something from you. It's stealing your life away.
Right.
You know, and so,
I wanted to say about the way they promote it, though, is important because, you know, for example, Tupac Shakur, you know, is one of the most popular figures in the world, you know, for music and his activism and all. And I did a lot as best I could to tell people about his activist side was huge. I mean, he was a one-time leader of the New African Panthers when he was 17, 18 years old. And so he then took on a new project, which was to pretend to be this gangster in order to appeal to gangs and politicize them as part of his Black Panther extended family's work in getting the Bloods and Crips to call peace truces internal into activism in 1991, around the time of the Rodney King beating and L.A. riots. And so, which, were also called L.A. rebellions for, because they were rebelling against that police, brutality case and other police brutality cases. But so he was an incredible activist. But I argue that he got manipulated to smoke weed a lot and promote weed in his lyrics. But he was actually getting away from weed at the very end of his life. And he was, he was engaged to Quincy Jones's daughter, Kadada Jones. And he, people saw him at parties like Russell Simmons, who produced, Def Jam, was Def Jam owner and produced, Run DMC and other bands. He saw Tupac at a party in the last months of his life, saying everybody, all the rappers and everyone there was smoking and drinking, smoking weed all, and drinking all night. And Tupac wasn't touching either alcohol or weed. All he would do was dance all night. And so he was changing. He was really settling down, getting away from the weed. He was only 25 years old, but he was making serious changes. And yet, it's sad that, he before that he had promoted weed a lot, and that's what they focus on. That's what the media focuses on, because they want to promote weed to youth and to say, smoke a blunt like Tupac. And and so it's sad that they know that Tupac was changing and maturing, at 25 years old and really getting back more into his activism and having such an effect with his activism and getting, gangs across the country, particularly the Latin Kings, to turn on to become the Almighty Latin King Queen Nation in New York. And I talked to King Tone, at length about some of this, what he was doing. And when they came down on King Tone and they framed, they actually had this huge mass arrest of all the Latin Kings in New York City. They found not a single joint on any of them. They found no drugs. They found one bullet shell total in somebody's trunk, and that's it. So it showed they had massively changed. And, professors documented this in a book, that they had become activists. They turned on to activism and gave up drug dealing. And the problem with that is it took a huge amount of money out of the CIA's traffickers' hands and out of the banks who launder that money. It took even more money out of their pockets. And so that's why, U.S. intelligence, murdered Tupac. But it's too bad that before he died, he couldn't promote sobriety, which is what he was threatening to do, the same way as Kurt Cobain. He had sobered up at the end of his life and was threatening to promote sobriety, as was John Lennon and to another different degree, and Jimi Hendrix to another degree.
Yeah, the people that are around me, I know a lot of gang members still, black gang members, Mexican gang members, and when I still, I talk to them, and because I used to be a gang member myself, and I always tell them, I say, dude, this is a lie, man. They got us going in circles, man. This is a lie. Yeah. I said, I always tell them this, check this out, man. When you go to Mexico, everybody knows who the cartels are. Everybody knows who's running the show in different parts and what, what groups are who and who's running what. I go, but as soon as you cross the border to come to the United States, nobody knows nothing. Nobody knows who are the cartels in United States. It becomes quiet. I go, isn't that weird though, that the United States is the biggest consumer of drugs, yet we don't know who are the main cartels here? I said, look it, the people that go to jail and go to prison, I always tell my homies this. I said, look it, if you're going to go and sell dope, your longest shelf life by the max is going to be 10 years. Anything else is going to be a year to 5 years, you're done. You'll be in the feds or you'd be doing prison time. That's it. The longest, if you're really pushing weight, but you're out there and you're a minority out there, the longest that you're going to last is like 10 years. I go, it's weird because they allow all these drugs into our neighborhood. And yet I would always say this. Isn't it weird how you know one person and this one person happens to know all the drug dealers and everybody's going to her house or his house and no, you know, and how can this person know so much information about all these people? But yet you begin to start seeing people getting busted that are surrounded by this one person, and this one person never gets busted. Ever. They can have people getting shot in front of their house, doing all kinds of craziness, but yet they never get busted. And I always tell them, I said,
they're part of the U.S. intelligence drug dealing network, of course.
Right. And I always tell them, I said, you know, we need to wake up because you know who's losing? I said, it's us, man. You know, and to my friends, I said, they put us in the prison system for what? They're making money off us in the prison system. You know, the judges are making money. I go, who's losing? It's us, man. It's us that's losing. You know?
You heard that documentary, Cash for Kids, that where judges were getting kickbacks for, you know, sending a lot of kids to these federal prisons, you know, these for-profit prisons.
Right.
So these companies were giving them kickbacks to do that. Yeah.
It's insane, man. It's insane. And the way to stop it, it's like this. Just stop doing it. Don't sell it.
And that's some of the intention of my book and film, is to get people to get out of that game and say, you know, look, there's government undercover agents all around you, or people that are like one or two people away from, you know, the agents who are directing things and manipulating people. And that's just the way it is, sadly enough. Yeah.
Let's talk about Rick Ross, Freeway, since we're in the LA area. Let's talk about Freeway Rick Ross and that whole scenario and how that got brought out.
Yeah, so basically Gary Webb, you know, wrote the article for the San Jose Mercury News. It was supposed to be a headline article for two straight weeks, you know, headline articles for the incredible investigation he did about the CIA Contra crack, you know, campaign. So he started coming out with those articles, and they became, you know, viral, you know, around the country, one of the first viral articles. And, but people even before him, a guy named Bob Perry had written great articles for Newsweek about the same subject. Webb might have, you know, gotten a little more detail on the subject, but others had also, you know, printed this information before them, that the CIA had its own private army, the Contras, that were fighting the Sandinistas, because the Sandinistas were a socialist revolutionary group that toppled the CIA-supported puppet, you know, group of puppet dictator of Somoza, the Somoza family that controlled Nicaragua for many decades. So the CIA, Sandinistas topple him, and then they introduced the country to socialism and basically raised the literacy rate incredibly fast. The whole country starts reading incredibly fast. They feed the country, they give them national health care, they do all kinds of good things for Nicaraguans. The U.S., of course, didn't like that. So they fund the Contras, an army, to try to topple the Sandinistas. And they a lot of those Sandinistas that are part of the CIA, a lot of these Contras that are part of the CIA army are then helping ship cheap cocaine from Central America and South America. And believe it or not, other people that are helping with that trafficking were former Nazis that were part of that were saved by the CIA and given refuge down in that area. Now, the New York Times estimates it was about 9,000 Nazis that were given refuge in the South American, Central American areas after World War II. But some German journalist I have in the film says about 50,000 Nazis actually were in that area. But people like, Klaus Barbie, who was called Butcher of Lyon for butchering so many people in France, he headed the Bolivian, what they called cocaine coup of 1980, that toppled a freely elected leader to get the cocaine lord's leader in power. And so this is where some of that, you know, cocaine work trafficking was coming from. But here's the CIA army of Contras that is getting all this cheap cocaine into the United States, and their point person in the U.S. was Freeway Ricky Ross, who was then turning into crack and selling it nationwide. but using networks of gangs to help him do that, including, you know, Bloods and Crips gang members. But I would argue that a lot of those assets of his who were, you know, working with the gangs, such as Michael Harry O'Harris, were also, Michael Harry O'Harris and was one of two top assistants of Freeway Ricky Ross when he was working with the Bloods at, you know, distributing cocaine throughout, you know, Los Angeles. He ends up finding, he ends up founding Death Row Records. And Death Row Records turns out to be a U.S. intelligence front company, because there was dozens, you know, high-level police detective Russell Poole, when he was investigating Biggie Smalls' murder, he found that there was dozens of his fellow police officers at all levels of Death Row Records. And when he talked to his superiors, he says, what are they doing there? And they said, you can call them troubleshooters or covert agents. And so what he found was that Death Row Records was trafficking cocaine and guns around the country. And they were also trying to lure Tupac Shakur onto the label to then set him up to manipulate him to put out, you know, songs that were more negative, but then kill him when he tried to get away from them and tried to get, you know, more into activism more overtly. And they also tried to end the Bloods versus Crips gang peace truces that Tupac was helping engender throughout California. So they had multiple projects, they were, you know, obviously, as I say, best evidence shows that U.S. intelligence front company. Russell Poole tried to get this word out on this, and I argue I show the evidence. Well, I don't get to say it in my book and film, but I already seen evidence that I believe he was end up murdered for doing that. And three top L.A. actors, Johnny Depp, Sly Stallone, Sylvester Stallone, and Leonardo DiCaprio, were all scheduled to play Russell Poole, this police whistleblower, in three different movie projects. And Los Angeles Police Department ended up shutting them all down, the most recent one being Johnny Depp's attempt, which was supposed to come out this past year. I actually saw the preview in film theaters in Baltimore this past summer, but it was closed down at the last minute before it could come out. DreamWorks project was closed down with Leonardo DiCaprio too, as I said. And so that's how powerful the LAPD is with its CIA connections to, you know, close down the whistleblowing, you know, of Russell Poole.
Right. Right. I know we got a little bit of time left, but I just want to talk about recently there was a death over here in Los Angeles of the rapper named Nipsey Hussle. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, sure.
Now, there's rumors going around stating, it's a fact that Nipsey Hussle was going to do a documentary about the court case of Dr. Sebi, or Sebi, however you say it. And it was Dr. Sebi was the person that said that he can heal through herbs and, you know, that all diseases has to do with inflammation and mucus. Now, he was just going to focus on the film. The film was just going to focus on the court cases itself. It wasn't going to focus on anything else. It was going to focus on the court case that happened in New York City and the federal case. And both cases he won. So he had proved that he can heal, you know, AIDS, sickle cell, hepatitis, diabetes, through just herbs. Now,
amazing.
Right. Yeah. So what they were saying is, he was this person that killed him. His name was Eric Holder. This person that had killed him, they were saying that he had just came out of a mental institute 2 weeks prior. And not only did he just come out of a mental institute, but he was a known police informant. So, you know, and so there's that rumor going around, well, maybe he was killed because of not only just that film, but his activism of wanting to bring peace in the neighborhood. He was really about like ending the gang violence and trying to help people better themselves. So, mm-hmm. but this happened to be the person that killed him happened to be somebody that was from his own neighborhood. So I don't know if you've heard anything about that, you know.
I have heard some about that, but what you said is more than I've heard, so I appreciate that. What people have to understand is that there were two headquarters for a national basically police network of, you know, it's a U.S. intelligence network in general, really, but police intelligence was working on targeting rappers in New York and Los Angeles were the two centers of this. And I show all the evidence supporting that in my book. I didn't have time to really put, you know, lay that out in my film, but in my book, I go into detail around all that. The Miami Herald in the 2000s, early 2000s, came out with an article which revealed that New York and LA, the headquarters for the hip hop units, they called them, were training some the Miami police unit on this hip hop, you know, task force, pretty much, and having a book when all the rappers, you know, illegal surveillance of rappers, not, you know, who weren't automatically known to have committed crime. So it was illegal surveillance of the rap community in Miami. So they revealed this in a Miami Herald article in the daily, you know, newspaper in Miami. What they showed a timeline of you know, criminal activities in Miami with the rap community, and it showed that murders started happening after this hip hop unit were trained by the New York and, you know, LA headquarters of, you know, for the hip hop, by the hip hop units in focused surveilling these rappers. So all the best evidence shows that this hip hop unit was not just about surveillance, but it was also about murderous targeting. And so, you know, Los Angeles being one of the top two places for this is just more evidence that, you know, amongst the loads of evidence I have that, you know, this is what's going on in LA. They are fatally targeting black rappers who turn on to activism and go against their agenda, such as, you know, getting gang members to turn on to positive activities and to do peaceful things. And they, you know, it totally makes sense that they would, you know, get this guy in a mental hospital. You know, basically, it's easy to use. I mean, you know, as I said, Project MKUltra boasted about being able to use drugs and hypnosis to get people to do anything they wanted and to murder people, to carry out assassinations. And so it's good evidence that this guy, that's what he was about, and, you know, and that he was already working for the police as an informant. Is even more evidence that this is what happened, sadly enough, to Nipsey Hussle. And it's very sad that you know, this is the way it happened. But it's also pathetic that the New York Times tries to cover it up in an article on the front page today and pretend like it's just dangerous to be in your own community doing good things because someone might just kill you for no reason at all. You know, they pretend like there's like such a little reason that people just want to kill someone else. You know, it's not worth, you know, repeating some of the reasons they gave in this article.
Right. I think they just want to start, you know, the gang violence again because it's been really low over here in LA. You know, I mean, after that killing, there was like four people that got shot after he was killed, you know, like right away. You know, they're just trying to explode it, you know, and
After Tupac got killed, gang violence started again. About 9 people or 10 people were killed after Tupac was killed because they tried to start up, you know, end the gang truces and start up the violence again. But activists quelled it again after that, after Tupac, after Tupac's death, shortly after Tupac died.
You know, it was crazy. They had a visual for Nipsey Hussle right there at his clothing store. And there was a lot of people that were there. And then 6 people got stabbed and were sent to the hospital. Just for a peaceful gathering. Something happened where people started going frantically running around or something like that. And then 6 people got stabbed.
What people have to also understand is that many of these gang members are also actually undercover cops. Okay. And they're doing some of this in the guise of being a gang member. That's what I found out was happening with in Death Row Records. And some of the people in Death Row Records were also supposedly gang members, but they were at the same time undercover cops. So that's the way it appeared to play out.
Right, man. It's insane. Well, I know John Potash, I know Mr. Potash that you got to get going. I thank you for the little bit of time that you've given me. I appreciate it. I want everybody to go out and get the book. Okay. Get his book. Watch, you know, you can watch his documentary. I watch it on Amazon. So you can watch it there as it's called Drugs, as weapons against us, the CIA war on musicians and activists. And is
yeah, so it's on Amazon Prime. It's streaming on Amazon Prime, but you can also find it a lot of other places streaming. And, you know, just for a few bucks, you can see it. But it's also, yeah, you can go to my website, drugsasweapons.com, which will link you to more about the movie, to the movie website, but it also show you more about the books, Drugs as Weapons Against Us book, and the book, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, as well as I have a film based on the first book, too, about the FBI War on Tupac book. But that film seems to be stifled and stymied. Like, I can't, even though it's supposed to be sold by Amazon, I keep sending them books and they don't get them. So someone's stealing them out of the U.S. Post Office or something else is happening to stop them from getting from Amazon to Amazon. And people aren't seemingly able to buy them on my website anymore either. But hopefully, if you want to buy it from me, the film directly from me, you can through my website. So, you know, feel free to check that out. But thanks for having me on, Len. And hopefully there'll be another time when we could talk more about this. I'm sorry, I'm just so busy right now, but definitely in the future, we'll get into this more.
Right, right. I would love for you to come back on and let's get in depth about it. And I just want everybody to be able to just to get a quick snippet of what you're about and, you know, the research that you're doing. It's vital to our communities. It is, you know, I always tell people we need to educate people. You know, I mean, it's about education, because if you can give somebody, if you can teach somebody, instead of just feeding them, if you can teach them how to go and hunt and feed themselves, they become better people. So we want people not to be lazy. We want you to be active. So educate yourself, educate your children, protect your children, because this is real. This is not fantasy. This is what's really going on. And you are the target. You are the target. Your children are the target. And you just need to protect yourself and protect your family. Mr. Podash, thank you for coming on the show. Everybody, my name is Leonard Olivares. This is Eyes Wide Open. Thank you and God bless.
So they've got you. They've got you under a spell. You cast your cares down a wishing well. Yeah, you struggle to breathe, struggle to breathe, with two hands around your throat, around your throat. When will you realize the hands are your own, hands are your own, and you should let go. To fall, will you break the mold?
chains. You're living in chains. You're not living.
You know, I don't know any other name tonight under the heavens whereby men can be saved other than the name of Jesus.